This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
This is Beth from Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak Radio live on BBS Radio every Tuesday night at 8:55 p.m. to 9:55 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, or by going to our website at thepeoplespeakradio.com. There you can also listen to, you can not only listen to our live shows, but you can listen to past shows on our iPod Ready archives section. The People Speak is a live one-hour radio show that reaches people all over the U.S., Canada, and Australia, and even as far away as the United Kingdom. Our audience can call in by phone and speak with me and our guest by dialing 415-762-1161 or by dialing 712-432-0075 and entering access code 318116 pound sign. We're also excited to announce that you can now listen to our show via your smartphone, so there's no more excuse for not listening to some of the most fascinating people right here on the People Speak Radio. Tonight's guest is somebody that I'm really thrilled to interview, a gentleman by the name of Phil Martin. Phil has written a book called The Zen Path Through Depression. Now, Phil Martin has practiced Buddhism for over 30 years and has a degree in Buddhist psychology, and he's also worked as a social worker and case manager for 25 years. He does workshops, and this new book is just delightful. Hi, Phil, it's wonderful having you on the show.
Well, thank you for having me, Basma.
The way that you have the book set up is really nice, and I'll tell you why. Because sometimes, as a former depressed person, so I kind of know it, but I know it differently than you know it, and I'm sure that doesn't surprise you. Reading something voluminous is a lot of work for a depressed person, isn't it, Phil?
It is, and so I specifically tried to make it simple and short chapters with exercises, so people didn't just get lost in pages and pages of description. Or the other thing I think is a lot of the books kind of tell you do this and do that, and it's hard to sometimes sort through, and it's hard to even do the things that they're suggesting. So I tried to more gently make suggestions and just have people explore some of what they were going through rather than immediately try and get out of it and get all caught up in busyness and trying to get away from it.
And Phil, as far as the book goes, this is not something that is written from afar. This is written from within, isn't it? You've had issues with depression in your life.
I did, and that was one of the things that led me to writing it. And also seeing some friends and coworkers and the struggles they had also taught me a lot and was one of the things that led me to wanting to share some of what I'd experienced and learned from it.
Well, I know that for myself, and as I read some of your book and parts of the parts that I didn't manage to finish yet, this was different. My depression was different for me, and I'll tell you how. My depression was something that I didn't know I had. I just kind of lived my life and didn't know that I was depressed. And there's a great commercial that I just, when the first time I saw it, it was like, oh my God, that's it. And I never knew how to explain my depression except to say that it was like Claritin Clear. I don't know if you've ever seen that commercial.
Yes.
Where everything was just a little bit foggy and then suddenly it became clear. And so for me, entering into the realms of meditative practice, entering into an enlightened form of thinking, more holistic approaches to these things. Actually, the awakening came with me, and the depression left me at pretty much the same times, but I don't see that that happened with you here. From my understanding is that even during your meditative work and your understanding of enlightenment and how it worked, and that you were still battling depression. Am I correct in that? Hello?
Hello, I lost you there for a moment.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you hear my question about, I was suggesting that my particular path kind of was simultaneous, my enlightening experiences and the loss of my depression or the coming out of my depression were kind of simultaneous with me. But with, from everything that I can see in your book, The Zen Path Through Depression, you kind of struggled with depression throughout, if I'm not mistaken.
No, I did. And I think, you know, in telling your story and your experience with it, one thing that stands out with that is I think that frequently people who may have depression and aren't even aware of it, oftentimes are the ones that are drawn to a spiritual practice. You know, it's oftentimes our suffering that leads us to begin to ask the questions about what matters in life, how can we escape that, how can we find joy. So interestingly enough, in my years of studying Zen and being around groups where other people were practicing it, oftentimes you found people with a fair amount of maybe undiagnosed depression, and that was part of what led them to try and find some answers. And I think for me and what I see frequently is that people who are already trying to make some attempts to live a spiritual life or in a within a religious practice, oftentimes what we do with it, and it just feeds right into the kind of self-blame and feelings of worthlessness that go along with the depression, is that people will oftentimes feel, you know, this is a sign that I'm not practicing hard enough. And they may go to sometimes their spiritual guides, and if people don't understand depression or haven't experienced it themselves, they'll even be told that. I've heard a lot of stories from people in all kinds of traditions who go to a priest or a rabbi, a teacher, and what they're told is, well, you need to practice harder, you need to pray harder, you need to be more selfless, and this will go away. And, you know, I think those same people would never think of just dismissing physical illness in that way, but they will do that, and that just unfortunately feeds into this feeling people have that they're already not working hard enough, and they just try and spin their wheels and work even harder and just get more stuck in the situation they're in, I think, is what happens.
I think that's an interesting metaphor that you just brought up, the spinning your wheels and getting more stuck in the mud, because I think a lot of people, especially people that are dealing with depression, will understand that kind of feeling. It is exactly like that. It's like you're spinning your wheels. You think you're doing something, but you really end up not doing anything and are just stuck in this place, and you don't know what you're doing wrong, so you assume naturally that you did something wrong.
Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things I thought, that in all of these sufferings and all of these difficulties, I think there lies the possibility of learning some things, that they're the seeds of self-learning or changing. And so when you look at that sense of that you're doing something wrong, it gives you a chance to, first of all, look at the fact that you may always go right to the place of blame, of blaming yourself or blaming others. Maybe you're the kind of person that when things do start to get difficult, you do just get busy or put your head down and try and just muscle your way through it. So a lot of the coping mechanisms we have, which may not work that well, are, of course, magnified because we're in so much pain. We're struggling so much that we just keep trying to do what we've always done to get out of it, and this can give us the chance to maybe see a different way.
You have an interest, as I said, I really enjoy the way the book is set up. First of all, again, and I will repeat this for people that are listening and are struggling with depressive disorder. Sometimes a whole book is too overwhelming, but bits and pieces of books are very comprehensible. And this book is delightful in that each area is an area of depression on its own. And you deal with the issue, you deal with how you feel about it, you deal with ways and techniques to zen right through it, which is very interesting. And I just love this. I love the, like as I said, I just love that it is practical that way, and it works with people that are actually depressed. Now, let me ask you, how long before you, or do you still struggle with depression, Phil?
I do from time to time. I seem to finally get a picture that mine has a something of a seasonal component, which is mm-hmm. not good when you live as far north as I do. Frequently you see that when the days grow shorter, which, you know, I think also interestingly enough would seem to point to, so often people want to think, I think because they don't understand if they see someone going through this, or they want to feel that it's not anything that they're at risk for having happen, and they look at it as this is simply a state of mind, and if you just chose to be happy, you'd get out of it. And when we can see things like prolonged stress, or something as clearly physical as the amount of light striking our retinas can cause it, it tells you that there's a huge physical component to this also. So I do still have periods where I will find myself beginning to have symptoms of depression. I will. I think I've learned even more now to initially not fight it. I can take my own advice, I guess, and I can see it for what it is and not initially fight it and take action rather than trying to deny that it's there for months or years as I did before.
I think that's important, and I think we discussed this earlier today when you and I spoke. You said you take control of it now. And I really think that's such a valuable thing. We live in a world where a lot of people have given up, I believe, their right to be responsible for themselves. And when you say that, it's an empowerment statement. I can take control of it.
And you can take control of your own choices about, to a large degree, you know, are you going to do what will improve your life, what will make you feel happier and more joyful? And it's funny that there seems to be a difference between getting lost in blame and just taking responsibility, accepting that this is yours and you need to do whatever works for you once you've made the decision that you want to begin to change things. And too often people, you know, not to disparage medications in any way, but for some people it's a lifesaver, and I think it's important to remember that. I tried to write the book for people. There were a number of books out there that kind of just say, you know, just change your thinking a little bit and things will improve. That may be the case for people with more mild depressions, but I tried to give something that would also be helpful to people in very serious depressions. And I was always struck when I would tour or give talks along this line that people would come up afterwards, and every time I spoke, someone would say, I'd lost a family member, I've lost a friend to depression. You know, I think we need to remember that 33,000 people in this country every year commit suicide, and about 90% of those are suffering with depression. So it's serious and it's fatal. And that's why I don't disparage medications at all. But I think we are so caught up in our culture and society right now that we don't want to take responsibility. We want the quick fix. We want to go to a doctor and have him prescribe something and not have to do any work on our own part. And nothing that's worth achieving comes without some effort on our part, and I think we need to remember that.
I think that there's a lot of confusion about depression, too, Phil, if I'm not mistaken. And I'm certainly and by no means an expert, but having lived through depressive, a low-grade chronic depression for probably the half of my life, I would say, and coming out of it and able to witness what I was, how I lived my life, and what I see, has given me at least a perspective on it. There are so many different. Depression is going to be different with each person. Some people have clinical depression based on metabolic disorders. There are sociopathic types of depressive disorder. There are clearly issues of not being able to deal effectively with life conditions, environmental depression. So for those that are listening, I would highly recommend that obviously that you go to a doctor and have all of the tests. I mean, I personally believe in a blending of traditions, both in medical technology and holistic therapies. And,
I absolutely agree with that, because there are,
yeah.
say, there are people that may be something as simple as a thyroid disorder.
Exactly.
And then they can look at either traditional or alternative therapies to deal with that, and instead of having to live in that, I think you described it so well, that kind of sense of things are fuzzy. I liken it sometimes to being in a room where someone slowly turns down the light, and you don't realize it's getting darker and darker until suddenly you realize you can hardly see.
Yeah.
So people don't realize that's happening, but it's important because it's something that's difficult to see on your own to get, if you feel at all, you may be struggling with it, to get an opinion from somebody else, and as you say, get someone that's knowledgeable. You know, so many people just go to see their family physician, and they're more willing now to prescribe things than they used to because the medications they feel are much safer than they used to be. But they can.
Well, I mean, as a personal, personally for me, and I've never taken any medications for depression because I was able to take control of my life. I gained better tools. I did meditate. I did heal spiritually. So for me, I was very blessed to have it that way. But I'm not opposed to necessarily to people taking medication as kind of a jump start.
Yes, absolutely. It's kind of like when you're drowning, the medications can be that life preserver that gets your head above water, and then you can decide.
Get your head above water and then worry about the rest.
Yeah.
But again, too, unless there is absolutely a clinical reason for it, I would hope that eventually, you know, other therapies would enhance that healing. And that's important. Boy, we've got a lot of questions already from some of our listeners here, Phil, and I'm going to put this one in because obviously I don't want to get too far into it before we understand some of your practices and how you have used Zen Buddhism to help heal yourself and to educate others on how to heal themselves. Mike in California asked, what experience has the guest had with Zen Buddhism, teachers, schools, meditation practice, that type of thing?
My study began in my first year of college. Someone had given me a book. I don't know if Mike is familiar with Foundations of Tibetan Mysticism. It's a rather thick and dense book, but what the practical and really basic teachings of Buddhism just shone through that, and it just seemed to make a lot of sense to my experience and what I was looking for in my life. And it's always funny and interesting, I think, for me. It was a learning experience just in itself in going to study. I, you know, got on fire with this new thing I wanted to learn and experience, and I went out to Naropa Institute, which is a Buddhist university out in Boulder, Colorado, for a summer. It's a Tibetan group. Chujan Trungpa was one of the founders of it. He's a Tibetan teacher. Mm-hmm. Went out there for a summer and came back to Minneapolis, where I lived, and just kind of found out that I wouldn't have needed to go so far. What I was looking for was right in my own backyard, 5 or 10 miles from where I had grown up and lived, was one of the most recognized Japanese Zen teachers in America at the time, who was Daniel Katagiri Roshi. Mm. So I was able to practice and study under him for, 10 to 15 years before he passed away.
Wow.
So that's been my experience.
Well, that's wonderful. Sounds like you've had a very well-rounded... we have a couple of other questions, but I think I'd like to talk to you about... wait a minute. Alan in Oregon asks, what does Buddhism say about the victim mentality, which I sense is often a source of depression?
I think he's right in there, and that it's a... It can be... I don't know if victim mentality is the right way to look at it in some ways. Very much comes from, oftentimes people have been victimized. Some of the things, interestingly enough, that are some of the best indicators for depression are things like poverty and economic hardship. And it becomes, there was a lot of study and research done into this idea of learned helplessness. If you are in a situation or come from a group where you are generally made to feel powerless, you're of course going to begin to start to really just generally feel that way all the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to say victim mentality, I think I don't want to blame people who may have every reason for feeling that they're not very empowered. But Buddhism, it really does get down to, at the very basic level, the fact that the main teachings are that life is marked or characterized by suffering, by kind of this intense feeling of dissatisfaction is another translation of it, that it's our, and that we are the causes of that. It's in our desires for things that will make us feel good, that will, we can find a way to make them last, and we know nothing's going to last, either the good or the bad, that's what really causes our difficulties and our suffering. And what Buddha taught was that we can, as you said, take control of that. We can choose to set forward on a path that's going to lead us to ways that are going to bring us more joy, that are going to, and no one else can do it for us. One of the very last things Buddha said was to his followers as he was lying ready to die, was to, he said, work out your salvation with diligence. Work it out for yourself. There's no outside force that's going to do it for you.
Well, there's a couple of your your quotes in here that I think are very appropriate in this. One of them is by John Trudell, who says, what we can't face looks for us anyway. So not always are we not always victims of our own mentality. We are oftentimes victims, but not knowingly victims,
mm-hmm.
especially when you're in a depressed state. I don't think people really see themselves as victims. Well, some do, but I think that the overall experience of depression is a lot more deep. I don't think I remember when I was like that, or as I look back and I was thinking of myself as like that, I didn't really know that I was depressed, so how could I have become a victim of it? I just thought, is this all there is?
Mm-hmm. This is how life is. Everybody else must be just barely a notch above miserable and somehow get through their lives and not...
Or they must be doing
more.
It better than I am.
Yes.
Somehow. that was my big thing. The other thing is, and... This is another statement, and it says by Hakun, and it says the very body is Buddha. So everything is Zen, everything is Buddha. And for us to different, I don't think in Buddhism there is a true differentiation between the victim and the mentality, is there?
No, there really isn't. And that the nice thing about that Hakun quote too is that there's not. As we see so often in the West, and I think sometimes it's a misreading of Christian teachings, but the sense that the body is something foul and to be transcended. Zen teachings in particular said this body, this mind is where we're able to find enlightenment. It's the very vessel that allows us to do that, and so we don't try and transcend it or get rid of it. In fact, that was what Buddha learned when he was studying for many years before his enlightenment in India. He followed teachers who said, you know, starve your body, mortify your body, and that's the way to find happiness. And he found that wasn't the way. And prior to that, the story says that he was a prince who was raised in absolute luxury and sensual pleasures, and he realized that wasn't the answer either. And so he tries to, for all of us, steer a path between those two extremes.
Yeah. Oh, now we have another question. Elizabeth in Ohio asks, a friend of mine suffers from depression, and medication has many disturbing side effects on her. She's had a hard time of it. Can your methods help alleviate depression such that some of your patients are now medication-free? I'm assuming that she meant are any of the patients, the people that you worked with, are now that were on medication are now currently medication-free.
Well, and I want to clarify first that I'm a social worker, not a psychiatrist, so I don't usually people that I'm working with already are under the care of a doctor or a psychiatrist. Many of them do say that they're able to sometimes go off of medications, sometimes markedly reduce those they're taking as they learn some skills, as they learn some acceptance through mindfulness practices, so that there can be the positive results of both going off or reducing them.
May I ask you, obviously you have an attachment to Buddhism and Zen. Zen practice, in my own personal belief, I think that there is no right or wrong path, that you don't even have to do anything to really be Buddha. But let me ask you, why Zen? How did that help you?
Well, Zen is, it was just, you know, I think sometimes there are different schools of Buddhism as there are different schools of Christianity, and sometimes... it may have grown out of the different cultures that they developed in, but often those are suited to different kinds of personalities, I guess. I always kind of, from when I first encountered it, enjoyed the Zen aesthetic. A lot of the writings and teachings have to do with nature, and I think that comes out of the Japanese culture. There's a focus on writing and poetry, which has always been something that, since I was 11 or 12, has been important to me. So it was that, and also just the, it's something that purports to be very simple and get right to the heart of the matter without a lot of extraneous philosophizing. It's it focuses on a meditation practice and a way of dealing with day-to-day that is to bring us as strongly as possible into just full awareness of our lives and taking joy in our lives.
Well, that's beautiful. You know, you have one chapter that's called, excuse me, allergy season is killing me this year. and one of your chapters is titled An End to Suffering. That is so huge. And I love this word. I've pondered suffering a lot. And one of the things that I found, and I found this to be true in more cases than not, especially with myself and with people that I ponder about, is that we suffer oftentimes over our suffering.
Mm-hmm.
The pain we have often heard is inevitable, but suffering is a choice. But to suffer over our suffering, oh, poor is me, I have chronic fatigue, I have depressive disorder, I have this, I have that, I can't sleep, and all of these things are me, by the way, just in case anybody didn't figure it out. And then I said, well, why not me? And at that point, I had chosen to stop suffering over my suffering.
It's a matter, I think, another way of putting it is of resisting the suffering. And it's one of the nice things that meditation provides, of course, is really strong experiential ways to find out these things. And I will oftentimes tell people that suffering over suffering is a little bit like if anyone's ever tried sitting for any length of time, you know, your foot goes to sleep, or it may be as simple as an itch. And if you've decided you're not going to scratch that itch while you're sitting there for the 10 or 15 minutes, you can start with that tiny little itch and become so upset over it that, you know, I want this to go away. I'm going to somehow will it to go away, of fighting it rather than just accepting it and not resisting it. So that by the time the 10 minutes are up, the itch may be gone, but you ache all over because you've been fighting so much, or your entire body becomes tense and painful because of a pain in your knee. And I think that's partly too what you're saying, and that is very common in depression that we, as you say, you agonize over the suffering.
Exactly.
It's possible to find joy even in that suffering, because that's kind of the that's this world that we live in. There's illness, there's what Buddha said is there's old age, there's illness, there's death. There are all these things that the body is subject to decay, and we're all going to experience that. So the best thing we can do is learn how to be joyful even in the midst of it.
One of the one of your chapters is about anger. How does anger feed that depressed beast?
I think, it again is different for different people, and that's one of these areas there where it can give you a chance to kind of study what your relationship is to anger. You know, so many people have heard there's kind of this the common belief is, well, depression is anger turned inwards. And that may be true for some people. I think people need to look at that. Some people, it comes from stifling their anger, refusing to express it. For some people, a little bit of anger is not a bad thing. I think of, you know, if you can look at it, you see sometimes that anger is really just an energy. And a little bit of that can help, because part of what you're struggling with in depression is it's almost like an illness of energy, where you move slowly, you don't have the energy to get up out of a chair and walk across the room. The interesting thing, I think, for men in particular, though, is that we've been culturated to pretty much feel that we're allowed one or two emotions. We can either be happy or we can be angry. So a lot of men are misdiagnosed because the only thing they know how to express is that anger, and rather than feeling teary-eyed and sad and down, the way they express it, or kind of partly the way they cover it up, is to be angry all the time. You think of I think we all know people or have uncles or people who are just, you know, those mean, mean old bastards. And I think sometimes it's they're just their way of dealing with the depression.
Yeah. You talk about time. I love what you say about that, that there is this psychomotor slowing that happens in our speech, in our movement, in our thought. But then what you say is that this can actually be almost a very cathartic time, a very meditative experience. So is that how you use that to help deal with the slowing of time, as only a depressed person can know slowing of time?
I think it is. You know, I think one of the things is depression in that way, and a few of the other symptoms can have you reevaluate things that you just accepted as being normal or valued. People who are depressed may feel they can't work, and that really lets them look at, well, is it working 50, 60 hours a week is all that makes you valuable or worthwhile? Is it normal to lead the kind of lives we live where, if our computer takes an extra 5 seconds to load a page, we're just frustrated and can't believe how long it takes. And rather than thinking of the miracle that we can
load
get
page.
All this information, yeah, in a matter of seconds. And instead, we're just angry that it's not faster. And I think, you know, I think most people would agree. It seems the pace of life is faster all the time. And so it can give us a chance to see, well, you know, it's not the slowness of depression that's false. It's this speediness in which we go through life all the time that is false. Or it's perhaps a better way to put it is it's another choice. And we can choose whether we want to live at that pace or not.
And I'll tell our listeners here right now, and we are speaking to Philip Martin, who has written the book, The Zen Path Through Depression. This is a great exercise, and I'm thinking of it myself, thinking, oh, my gosh, how am I going to do this? And you ask us to drive 10 miles per hour slower today. What does it feel like when you don't feel the imperative to speed this current moment along? How do others seem to respond to you? How do you feel about this difference? And I'm thinking to myself, even in the times when, you know, have you ever slowed down because you just saw the police officer stopping somebody else and you got reminded, you're going too fast, you were really lucky, slow down. And then suddenly that shift in perception from going real fast and not even being aware of where you were going, how fast you were going, what you were doing, and suddenly I'm driving 10 miles or maybe even 15 or 20 miles slower, and I'm thinking to myself, wow, I feel more relaxed. It happens. It's amazing.
And there may be things we completely miss, too. You know, I've had those experiences of being lost in either racing to get to work on time or worrying about those people around me who are driving too fast and lost in thought. And if I slow down and just take a breath, there might be a rainbow behind me that I didn't even see because I've been so caught up in things that I miss some of the really beautiful things around because I'm moving so fast.
It's really, and why is it that, do you suppose we fight that so much, Philip? I can't imagine that the majority of people at one time or another have experienced that same shift in perception. Knowing that by either, we're using speeding as an analogy, but it could be in any arena. And, you know, that shift in perception obviously made us feel better. It gave us moments of time that we otherwise would have sped right through and forgotten. We are enjoying that those moments of time, and yet we persist on speeding through life anyway. Why do you suppose that is?
Well, I think sometimes part of it is that so often spiritual growth or the spiritual path, it comes back to the thing we were talking about at the very beginning there about self-responsibility. If we slow down and we begin to see that we actually can change our lives, that we can see the beautiful things, that we can bring some joy into our lives through our own decisions and the way we live, it makes it a lot harder to kind of go back to being mindless and missing those things. You know, with every bit of knowledge, it's kind of like you've raised the bar in what you need to do next, and sometimes we don't like to recall that we can be happy, that we can be responsible for ourselves in our own lives. It's just a little easier sometimes to not be so.
You know, going back to the original thought of taking ownership and responsibility of one's own healing, you have in here the other aspect of that, which is seeing without blame. Who do we blame for our depression? Do we blame our ancestry? Do we blame our genetic codification? Do we blame our wives, our husbands, our children, our illnesses, poverty, fortune or unfortune? Who do we blame?
We tend to go between two extremes of either blaming ourselves entirely, and there's no... not necessarily, like I said, that's somehow blame is different than responsibility, I think. Or we blame other people, which is another way, you know, we were saying people want someone to fix them, and it's easier if you can blame someone else for causing the problems in your life. You, again, don't have to take responsibility for them. And I think ultimately the question is, what value is there in blaming anybody? Instead, it's more important to see where you are and decide what you need to do next once you can accept and stop fighting where you are and begin to decide what you want to do.
Hmm.
Blame somehow keeps us stuck, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, I agree. I absolutely agree with that. Let me ask you... And I'm not putting it into your universe. This is just an analogy, universe. We're just kidding. Don't take me seriously. Tomorrow morning you were to wake up depressed, what would be your first action?
I would try, first of all, to... I heard someone tell a story about sometimes when they knew someone who'd... had a deep loss in their life. The person that was close to them had passed away, and the story goes that the person asked the person bringing them the news for tea, and they said, you should always try and go about living your life and do what you're going to do anyway. I hope I would do would be to, first of all, take my own advice and sit down and meditate and get myself centered and see where I was at, and then begin to be able to decide what I needed to do. I hope that I'd be open-minded enough. I think one of the things I talk a little bit about in the book was here I had been working for a number of years as a social worker, and I would tell people when they were depressed, you know, don't beat yourself up for that. This happens to a lot of people. There's no value in blaming it, and don't say, I'm just going to somehow get through this. Be open-minded about what may be the steps you need to take, whether it's seeing a doctor or seeing a counselor. And yet when I first experienced it, I did the complete opposite of what I would say to a person I was working with or even say to a friend. I just started berating myself and saying, well, this is just because you're not working hard enough, and don't think you're going to ask for any kind of help. You just need to get yourself out of this and not... reach out in any way. And I think one of the things I've learned now is that I don't go immediately to that old way of thinking, which is to blame myself, to berate myself, that I'm willing to, first of all, accept it and think about what I need to do and ask for some help in doing what it is that I need to do to feel better.
The value of uselessness. One of your quotations states, meditation and spiritual practice really are worthless. If anybody knows anything about the practice of Zen, they call Zen the practice of ludicrous. I think it's ludicrous. And the reason is it can be kind of crazy when you think about Zen koans and mantras and just the stories, the little stories that the Zen Buddhist monks told. Then it goes on to say, in depression, we may often feel worthless, that nothing we do matters. We feel beaten down and used up, like an old scrap of cloth, not even useful as a rag any longer. But meditation and spiritual practice really are worthless. How do you explain that to somebody that's new to Zen and that really doesn't understand the ludicrous position that you've taken in Zen practice?
Well, I think part of it is getting at this idea that it was something that Chujun Trungpa, the first person I had studied with, really identified in this idea that spiritual practice can become spiritual materialism, that it just becomes another thing that we're trying to accumulate. Rather than getting the new fancy car, we want to tell people, I went to this retreat here, or I read this book. It just becomes another thing to be acquired to kind of show that we are wonderful people, rather than, my explanation of it would probably be, spiritual practice is kind of outside that usual way of doing things. In fact, I think there's some description in Christianity of this, and certainly in Buddhism too. It's spoken of that some of this practice is against the stream. It's contrary to how the world usually works. That we're brought up to think our goal is to make money and get famous and get powerful. Those things are not going to make us happy. The other reason to say it's not, there's nothing to be gotten from meditation, is that rather than a process of building things up, it's really a process of letting things be the way they are. And it's one of the only experiences we do where we aren't necessarily doing it for a purpose. We're doing it because we want to slow down and let things be as they are supposed to be, rather than trying to gain more things or learn more things. So it's, and I think, when you can begin to talk with people about that, they can get a little glimpse that they don't have to work to get to some place. They might need to make some work or do some work to be right where they are and to be appreciative and aware of it. I sometimes say to people, I think the reason we strive so hard and make so much effort in spiritual practice is so that we can understand that we need to make that effort, but the real goal is to surrender. And so we make all that effort so that when we finally see that it hasn't done what we wanted to for us, just as strong as our effort is, our surrender can be equally strong then.
I often tell people that are just starting to blossom in their awakefulness that I envy them, that journey, because I don't think I've ever felt that sunshine that somehow seems to come from the inside out that you feel as you become enlightened and awakened to how things really are, how the universe works, that nothing is in vain and everything is in vain all at the same time. And I think that right there expresses the issue, the very concept and precept of Zen Buddhism. How?
Well, it's interesting. One thing that makes me think of is that there are actually two schools that kind of argued back and forth about does that enlightenment happen in an instant, or does it happen gradually? And you could say that the real answer is that
each one happens instantly, gradually.
Yeah. it's like you can be caught in a downpour and be drenched in a moment, or you can walk in a mist and be drenched after a long period of time. But the fact of being drenched is kind of time isn't as important as we like to think it is.
Yeah, it's really a very beautiful place if you allow it. So here, the Zen path through depression is an interesting way of coming to terms. You almost want to say, are we being healed from ourselves? Are we?
I think so. There's a way in which depression is an illness of the self. Because we kind of become so preoccupied with it. So it's hard to reach out from it, but oftentimes it's isolating, but at the same time, a part of our healing can be reaching out and thinking of others, making connections with others. I think it is a small death of the self in a way. And if we can stop fighting that, that's another piece that can be learned from it. The other thing I talk in the book about how we prize thought above all else. And in depression, oftentimes you can't remember things, your mind doesn't work very well, and you kind of learn the limits of our thoughts in that way also. I guess one thing I want to say and make clear is that for me, Zen practice has always been the thing that worked best for me and that I was drawn to. And so when I was in my depression, at first I kind of thought, this is about these heavy, weighty spiritual things, this practice. It's not about the day-to-day life that I'm struggling with in my depression. And one of the things that was the most healing for me was to realize that I could bring my depression into my practice, that I didn't need to exclude it. And I guess that's, if there is anything I can get people to take away from what I have to say, it's just that, you don't have to practice Zen practice, but if you have any kind of a spiritual practice or leanings, don't feel that depression robs you of that, or that you can't practice it with the depression. If just be gentle with yourself, and don't have the depression be one more thing you use to tell yourself you're not spiritual enough, whether it's Christianity or 12-step programs or Judaism or any of the other religions or spiritual practices. Don't be afraid to bring your depression into that and work with it.
Whatever works, work it.
Mm-hmm.
I know for me, this is something that I have learned through many, many years of trying to shed all those old things and people and places that I was at one time, but I don't feel that need anymore. And I look back at my depression and I see the beauty of it. And I see the beauty of not being depressed as equally valuable. And so it's not good or bad, I don't think. It's something, again, for higher learning and for our highest learning.
There's a wonderful poem by Rumi that I often read at workshops that I give, where he says, this body is a guest house, and we should not cast aside any guest that comes, whether it's grief or depression. It may be cleaning us out and preparing us for some newfound joys. And so, you know, that's part of that acceptance is to see depression as a gift rather than something awful to be got rid of at all costs.
Well, I think if we leave everybody with no more than that, I think that a lot of people will have gained a lot. Philip, I want to thank you for being with us on the People Speak tonight. We've had
a
wonderful time.
It's been a privilege.
Well, I appreciate that. And again, the Zen Path Through Depression, Philip Martin. It's by HarperCollins. You can pick it up on Amazon.com or you can. And do you have a website, by the way?
I do. It's all one word, thezenpath.com.
TheZenPath.com. There you go, folks. Go and learn. Be enlightened. Be zenified.
And be happy.
Thank you. And
thank
we'll see you next week, folks. Until then, let the people speak.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea, by the relief of death, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and